on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Oh my goodness, those Boston Red Sox can't get out of their own way. They got swept by the Rays this week, and we need to dig in once again on what's going wrong in Boston. Then we get a little bit happier talking about the White Sox, much better than the Red Sox. Those White Sox are in first place, and they're about to welcome the Los Angeles Dodgers to town. Tarek Skubal is joining the Tigers rotation this weekend, just a month after elbow surgery. And of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. So happy that soccer is finally doing a World Baseball Classic type thing. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And where were all the Czech pitchers last night?
Yeah, it's about time this sport gets a little global exposure. It's really, really good to see. Hopefully it can really ride this momentum and become an event that people truly respect.
Care about.
The World Cup the World Soccer Classic, as we will call it, has indeed begun. We will check in on it here and there along the way, but this is still a baseball podcast, and it is Friday, and it's time to talk about the Red Sox being bad at baseball again. That's our opener.
Life is what happens in between embarrassing Boston Red Sox stories. Jordan Schusterman, this franchise, after canning skipper Alex Cora back in late April, has not righted the ship. The latest exercise in ritual humiliation this week was a series loss in Tampa to what had been a middling of late Rays team. There was also inconsistent injury information being provided to the public on the club's two best players, Roman Anthony and Clash of Clans addict Garrett Crochet. The Red Sox are in a bad way. They have not won a series at home since firing Alex Cora. 0-6 at Fenway Park. The vibes in Beantown are bad. Maybe some of these Scottish football fans can bring their positive energy and beer drinking over to Fenway Park. The Tartan Army is exactly what the Red Sox need. There are a million and one places to start for this thunderstorm of woe. Jordan, where do you want to begin?
Yeah, maybe some bagpipe walk-up songs could really get some of these bats going.
Get Jaron Duran in a kilt.
I'm sure he would appreciate that. You mentioned the series.
I'm sure he would be very open-minded about wearing a skirt.
Seems like something Jaron Duran would surely support. The Red Sox were swept this week, as you mentioned. That was on the road at the Trop. Yep. We have talked about how awful they've been at home, historically bad at Fenway Park. The schedule gives them a couple of interesting home series coming up. They host the Rangers this weekend, the Blue Jays next week, before heading west to Seattle and Colorado, coming home for the Yankees and the Nationals. But for all the scheduled game we can play, it'd be like, oh, is this where they can get right? Is this right? It doesn't matter. When you're playing this poorly, we said this about the Mets early on. We looked at their schedule and said, oh, well, clearly this is where they turn their season around. When they have this many things going wrong, when you are missing this many important players, and when the stink of your franchise is just kind of emanating throughout all levels, from leadership to players to media to, it's just no one is feeling good. So there's not really a reason for us to think that it is suddenly going to get a lot better. But with the storyline of having fired your manager in April, we now have more of a sample of them playing baseball without Alex Cora. And as you mentioned, it hasn't gotten much better. Their winning percentage is slightly better. They were 10-17 before they fired Alex Cora. Since then, they are 17-22. So that's going from a 60-win pace to a 71-win pace. But altogether, it's 27-39. Which is one of the worst records in baseball. They're on pace to win 66 games. They are in last place in the American League East by four games behind the also blah Baltimore Orioles. And offensively, this is what has just not really improved whatsoever, particularly on the power side. If you do look at the pitching and the defense has been good the whole season. The pitching is what they were building this team on. And I know Garrett Crochet hasn't been a part of this recently, but if there is one thing that has gotten better since Alex Cora was fired, not that Alex Cora was the problem, the pitching has been pretty good. They're actually fourth in baseball in pitching pitcher F4 since Alex Cora was fired. They were 27th before then. And yet it doesn't matter because they can't hit the ball over the fence and aren't scoring runs.
I don't think that the Alex Cora firing is a particularly relevant data point when it comes to anything pitching related going on with the Red Sox.
Sure.
Did the Red Sox Red Wedding, the pitching infrastructure stayed. Like, that was a vote of confidence in Breslow's ability to get pitchers that get outs. They fired anybody that had ever given advice about swinging a bat and kept all the people that give advice about throwing the baseball. So I'm not shocked by that part of it. What is unique about the Red Sox to me when you compare them to the other teams that stink is that there's something almost Metsian about this team now. Where when the Mets were bad for much of their history, they were constantly doing these other embarrassing things, whether it was not getting their messaging straight or guys throwing gloves into the crowd or weird injury communication. It wasn't just the on-field results that were lacking. It was the whole energy of the operation. The Mets, even though they have been bad on the field this year, Jordan, they have not done dumb stuff, right? We are not laughing at individual things. They're not really moments in the same way. The Red Sox have taken that mantle. They have grabbed that torch and they have sprinted with it. This week, we got some weird Garrett Crochet injury updates. Now, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but Crochet, who has been out since, I believe, the end of April, beginning of May, was not good before he got hurt, probably pitching through some stuff. We had a report that he had not thrown, and then he said that he did not know when he would resume throwing. And this is after a series of optimistic updates coming out of leadership. Jordan, what do you make of the Crochet situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a situation where you mentioned it's, the Mets have had episodes that are just things you couldn't have even conceived of. But when it comes to injury updates, and the Red Sox are not the only team that have dealt with this, but this is such an important part of communicating to your fans.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's part of the job from a media and reporting standpoint that we often roll our eyes at, because when we go to the ballpark and we sit in the managerial scrums, it's not our job really to pry about when a guy's coming back, because we aren't beat reporters. And yet that is such a common part of the daily experience, is how's this guy doing? When is he going on a rehab outing? What are his status of baseball activities?
Yeah.
And in some cases, those are not that important. And it just feels like a silly back and forth that just feels like.
Well, it just totally depends on the importance of the player. Like the amount of times that people are like, hey, AJ Minter's lat. It's like,
sure.
Okay. But when we're talking about Garrett Crochet's body, anything has relevance. And so for the Red Sox to not get on the same page with when their best pitcher is going to be back, that's less than ideal.
Mm-hmm. And we've had a similar thing with Roman Anthony, where he has been dealing with this wrist injury, and it seemed like he was ramping back up, and then they said he was shut back down because he was experiencing discomfort. Roman Anthony also has not played. Yeah, I mean, Crochet hasn't pitched since April. Roman Anthony's last game was May 4th. These are their two best players. And with Roman Anthony, I mean, we haven't had a real update since June 3rd when they said, yeah, he's still not swinging. And this is, I think in this case, sometimes injuries are much more straightforward. He has an oblique strain. Now, that's not straightforward, but he has an oblique strain. We know what that sort of means. Oh, he has a hamstring strain. It seems like with both of these injuries, it's vague enough that it's much harder for fans to interpret or even build up any sort of hopes about when to expect them back.
Yeah.
And that that lack of clarity combined with how the team is performing, not that people think that Roman Anthony and Garrett Crochet can save the season, but any amount of, hey, this player that you really like and care about is coming back, you're just looking for any signs of positivity, and they can't even give them that.
And if anybody could save the season, it would be these two guys. This is the best hitter and the best pitcher in this organization. And I do think that is potentially what contributed to some of the mixed messaging here, where if things were going well with the Red Sox, the correct answer to these guys' injury situations is very nebulous. This injury is really tough to pin down. We don't really want to give a timeline. We'll update you as they do activities, right? Like, that's the correct answer. But when you need to provide a morsel of hope, you tend to offer a more optimistic, potentially unrealistically optimistic outlook on the timeline. And I think that right. is potentially what happened here. We also had this week President Sam Kennedy going on WEEI, or as I call it, WE, which is what the Red Sox season smells like. And giving both an apology and an update on these injury situations and, you know, saying our season is not going well, quote, I think it is important here at the outset to acknowledge how embarrassing, unacceptable, maddening, frustrating. My man's cooking on thesaurus.com. Whatever words you want to use, the past 2.5 months have been, there's no way to sugarcoat it. It's been awful, especially when you consider the stated goal of building upon what happened last season.
Yeah, I mean, this is a case where Sam Kennedy is trying to, sometimes what fans, the last thing the fans want to hear is pretending like everything's okay, or like exuding an amount of confidence to be like, trust us, bro. We got this. We're going to turn this around. You know, mixed in there, Sam Kennedy saying we're going to find a way to get this. But I think from a PR standpoint, he is attempting to be like, you're right, we suck. And that's not necessarily going to make fans feel any better. But I do think that that is still
is better
a better
than
way to directly acknowledge instead of what I think they were probably doing a lot earlier in the season and what a lot of teams do early in the season when you're struggling, which is say, we believe in our guys. We're going to get this turned around instead of leaning into these negative words that Sam Kennedy is going through thesaurus.com and saying all the reasons why fans, you know, should feel mad.
Well, so it's important to explain a little bit. I'm sure Red Sox fans know who is Sam Kennedy within this infrastructure, right? John Henry is the owner. He owns Fenway Sports Group. He's the big kahuna. We never see him talk publicly, right? Sam Kennedy is his spokesperson and his shield and his conduit to the team. Under that is Craig Breslow, who is in charge of baseball operations. And then under that is Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Sam Kennedy switching the messaging from trust us, we believe in our guys, to this is the worst time I have ever had working for the Boston Red Sox does feel like a pretty significant shift in the tone. Right. Even if this tone that they have adopted makes some sense and is better than one, not speaking or communicating to the public, and two, adopting this false sense of positivity, I do think that it is still notable.
I agree. I think to me, as let's just bring this back to Cora to kind of spin this forward weirdly. He has quotes in there, nobody's free of blame. Sam Kennedy is also interesting because he's been there this long. He has overseen many
all
of
this.
Pobo come and go, many a World Series triumphs, right? He has, of course, experienced a lot of success as well. That said, when you decide to make a very big organizational decision, which is to move on from Alex Cora, who, as we talked about when it happened, had amassed a lot of organizational power and influence, that is a statement about at that point who you do believe the blame falls with, or at least who you believe needs to be removed to move in a positive direction. And thus far, that has not occurred. And so when you do have ownership talking at the very top level, or in this case, Sam Kennedy doing his best to speak on behalf of, you know, who's making all the decisions atop the Boston leadership structure. Well, if nothing gets better, how long are you going to stick with the guy that you gave your vote of confidence for if you do believe that everyone is blamed? Because as we know, what does not happen in sports is the owners say, you know what, we're not doing a good job. We'll sell the team to someone who will take care of this better. No, there's always someone below them that they can find to fire. And but because it seemed like they had chosen Team Breslow, and yet you're willing to come out and say, none of this is okay, we still have to get better, all of us are to blame. Is there a point where they're clearly now going to have to balance, if this season continues to go where it's going,
yeah,
the stubbornness and the commitment to one side that does not seem to be working versus just actually trying to change something, which is, I know, what most fans want to see. And I will also say this dynamic is especially interesting when it comes to the trade deadline. And we've talked about with some teams in recent history, right? Because if you are willing to sell at the deadline, which, again, it will just depend on where they are in the standings and playoff odds and whatever, do you want someone who you don't trust leading your organization moving forward making those moves? Now, Craig Breslow got into more trouble recently making trades as a buyer. So maybe he would have a little bit more success trying to sell. At the same time, that is a weird dynamic. Are we trying to?
Yes.
But then who is going to come in and do your deadline? We talked about this with the Nats last year. These are difficult conversations, but hey, this is where you got yourself as the Boston Red Sox, and it's really embarrassing.
That is the last piece from this week. Craig Breslow, human robot, chat GP Craig, the communicator so bad that the Red Sox were reportedly looking for a English to English translator for Craig to communicate with the players. Breslow is good at some stuff, right? Like, he is good at pitching development. He knows his stuff in that field. So this week, you know, Sam Kennedy comes out and is like, we are not firing Craig Breslow. That is not on the table. Okay. I would say it not being on the table is a lie. And if not a lie, then irresponsible, right? Like, if you Sam Kennedy, if you are Sam Kennedy and the thought of moving on from Craig Breslow has not entered your brain, I don't know what to tell you, right? Like, you got to at least think about it. You have to evaluate what's happened here.
I agree with you. However, in a public speaking appearance here, what is he going to say? That is
what is he going to say? Yeah, you know, we've considered it. We've really thought about it. I don't know.
That is the thing that we are looking at, because boy, do we stink. So you have to, but this is true with manager firings too. You give votes of confidence until you don't, and you fire them. So it usually is not like a slow build towards, oh, we're thinking about it. Oh, yeah. Oh, boy, we just lost four in a row. Yeah, his job is definitely in jeopardy. And then you fire him. No, you say, we believe, we trust him. We are not considering that. He's doing his best. He's done all these great things. And then you fire him because that's the lever you pull when you're at the top
something
and you're not going to fire yourself.
There was something that Kennedy said that I really hated, which is that no one is working harder than Craig to figure this out. As if, like, he deserves pizza points for that. As if that's not his job. Like, yeah, I hope no one's working harder than your chief baseball officer to figure out why your baseball team sucks. Like,
yeah,
you don't get a ribbon for that. I would be more interested if it was the opposite. If Sam Kennedy was like, you know who's been phoning it in from an effort perspective? Craig Breslow.
All right, last thing about the Red Sox. Because
they're so funny.
We have just talked about the leadership and Cora and Breslow and Kennedy. And I mean, let's look at the baseball team for at least a second, right?
Yeah.
As is the case with most things in this world, don't like it, play better. The Red Sox are allowed to start playing better. There are no rules preventing them from winning baseball games. However, the problem right now is their offense is so punchless that and this is even if Roman Anthony magically felt amazingly better tomorrow, the lack of pop in this lineup right now is staggering. And this is even with Wilson Contreras, your big offseason addition, absolutely raking. This team has 52 home runs in 66 games. And normally it's not that simple where you just look at homers and say, wow, that's it's, you know, I guess you can have a good offense without home runs. The Brewers have done it quite well.
The Brewers.
But this is a below average offense. And they were 29th in WRC plus before Cora got fired. Again, we're talking about the changes in the hitting philosophy, changes in hitting coaches, whatever that means. 22nd since then, but it's still well below league average at 92 WRC plus. And to be last in home runs before and after is just incredible. I mean, they're on pace to hit 128 home runs this year, which would be the fewest in decades, or at least close to... They've only hit fewer than 150 once in the 21st century. That was 2014, which is up there among... I know the Red Sox have gone up and down pretty dramatically this century. We've seen them win, and as Sam Kennedy said, some high highs and some low lows. 2014 was pretty bleak. We know, because Johan Cespedes was playing for them. And it wasn't great. That team won 71 games. They only hit 123 home runs. But otherwise, to play in this park, we talked about how terrible they've been at home. It's just incredible to have this lack of slug. The pitching, the bullpen's been good. The pitching has been decent, but it's just not enough when you cannot score runs. It is a really, really meek and bleak offense to watch.
Would you rather have the Yankees 21st century or the Red Sox 21st century? I think it's an interesting thing to think about, because like the Red Sox have four titles, and like that is the ultimate goal. But the amount of volatility that goes on with this organization and the turnover and like the players that are on this team, it is jarring. There is whiplash. There is so much of a roller coaster ride. The Yankees have won one in this century, but they've been over 500 every single year since we were born. And they are usually in the playoffs. It just seems like a very interesting comparison, where people are always feel more mad at the, like, Red Sox fans feel more mad at the Red Sox than Yankees fans feel at the Yankees, you know? And the Red Sox are the ones with four rings. And so I think it's an interesting kind of like, what does winning give you? What does winning create? Like winning it all. What does winning it all actually do? Well, it buys you time. It buys you memories. It buys you glory. But it's not eternal, right? Like the frustration, and it depends on the market. Like Royals fans probably were happy for longer after they won than Red Sox fans were after they won, right? Because of the expectations. Just something to think about, something I've been chewing on. I will leave you all with this. Great little nugget in Alex Speer's recent piece over at the Boston Globe, that only one team in baseball history has come back from being 29 and 37 to make the playoffs. And that was the like 1914, you know, Boston Braves. Like,
And
they have dug themselves a hole late enough now where it's getting historically dicey.
Yeah. And as people are always right to point out, it's much different making the playoffs now with an expanded field. That said, their Fangraphs postseason odds have sunk to a season low 12%, which still sounds pretty good considering how bad it's been, but is not where they certainly expected to be at this time in the calendar. We are going to take a break. When we return, let's put on a different color socks and smile a little bit, because the Chicago White Sox are having a damn good time. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. The Chicago White Sox are in first place, and that's kind of a big deal.
What is going on the South Side? God is on their good side. Nailed it. 10 points to Gryffindor. The Chicago White Sox are rolling. They are in first place ahead of the Cleveland Guardians by percentage points, but who cares about percentage points? 2 years ago, this team was the worst team in the history of baseball teams. And now they are a damn good time. As entertaining of a watch as there is in our sport right now, these Chicago White Sox have provided an actual genuine sense of optimism within the fan base for the first time in forever. I am frankly surprised and over the moon for anybody that loves this club. Particularly happy for my good friend, Pope Bob.
This is a Dianu situation.
Oh,
I mean, it would have been enough for this team to be 500 and hitting a bunch of homers and calling up a bunch of prospects. They wouldn't be getting their own segment here, but it would be something worth celebrating. People would be feeling good. And yet here they are in first place.
You know who didn't
get
that reference? You know who wouldn't get your reference? Would be the Pope.
I disagree with you. I think that is something that he is a studied, learned religious man, and he understands my Dianu reference. Anyway, the White Sox are in first place, and yes, it is partially the product of the Guardians playing very poopy over the last couple weeks, and the rest of the division playing poopy over the entire season. However,
for the last 10 years,
this is not the A's being in first place, you know, under 500. This is a 36-31 ball club with a plus 10 run differential. And things on the roster that you actually look at and say, yeah, they're actually kind of good. We mentioned the home runs. They're fourth in the league in homers, sixth in the league in OPS. You know, the rotation, the pitching has just been okay. But when you're considering the depths that they were coming from, that is an incredible achievement. You do have some standout performers like Davis Martin. Everyone else is just kind of floating by. But when you have a good offense,
but this is the thing,
that's
dude.
Fine.
This is the
that's
thing.
That's fine.
When you look at a team that is overperforming, you need to get into the individual performances and say, is this sustainable? Are they doing this in a way that feels real? When I look at the pitching, I mean, they're a league average staff off of ERA, ERA plus, whatever, right? Davis Martin breakout feels real adjacent. Do I think he's going to have a 2-4-1 all year? No. Do I think he is a viable, you know, two starter? Yeah. I mean, he looks pretty great. Sean Burke looks like a perfectly viable Major League Baseball pitcher. Eric Fetty and Anthony Kay have not blown the doors off anybody, but they've been about league average. And that makes sense to me, right? Like, those are two guys where if you're getting league average performance, it feels sticky-ish. And then if you look at the offense, right, it's Colson Montgomery's been pretty good. Murakami, before he got hurt, was incredible. I am a little Miguel Vargas breakout. That feels real. We talked about that earlier this week during our All-Star conversation. Tristan Peters is the one where I'm like kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Would love to be proved wrong. But Sam Antonacci, who was a big part of the WBC, like, they're getting contributions from the players that make sense. This is not a Andrew Benintendi hot stretch, right? Mm-hmm. This is not, I guess it is Randall Grichuk being incredible, but it feels real to me, real enough. And someone asked me, you know, the other day, do you think the White Sox can make the playoffs this year? And I said, no, I still don't think so, because I don't think they have that second level of depth that they built this roster around. And the more I thought about that, the more I'm sort of changing my tune in my brain, because they do have a second level of depth. It's just not like these career big leaguers, the Adam Frazier's of the world that are going to fill in. It's prospects, right? And I think in a way that is actually more encouraging.
Yeah, I agree. It's certainly more fun to watch than leaning. I mean, sure, Randall Grichuk's given the fans some stuff to cheer about recently, but you have to imagine you'd rather it be the guys you drafted, the guys you got in a big trade that come up and feel like
the guys are that going to be here. Right. Yep. Like, is this White Sox team going to win the World Series? Probably not. You want the players that could be on the next team that does have a chance to win the World Series to be main characters. And this is kind of my last point about this White Sox season. As someone that once cared very deeply about the Baltimore Orioles, the first year is the best year when the team gets good again, because there are no stakes. You are playing with house money, where even if these White Sox finish 82-80, it's the best. And it reinvigorates your love and appreciation for the sport as a fan in a way that once there are expectations, it's more stressful. The White Sox are a carefree experience right now. And so if you care about this team at all, tune in as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, I think the one other part of their roster that feels convincing is some of the pieces in the bullpen. I mean, Grant Taylor is legit. And he probably should just be closing, and they could have spent their Sir Anthony Dominguez money elsewhere. Grant Taylor's great. Sean Newcomb, I really like that signing. He's been really good as well. I would also just say about them, we were just having a conversation with our Nats fan producer, Colin Brennan, about the Nationals, who are, as far as I'm concerned, the NL equivalent of the White Sox in a lot of regards. There are some parallels. There are some differences for sure. The Nats playoff odds. Now, the Nats did not have as good of a week as the White Sox, as we know, at least by the end. The Nats do not have as good of a record as the White Sox. Nats playoff odds are at 5%, according to Fangraphs. White Sox up to 26%, which in some ways still feels low.
Because they play in the AL Central.
Because they play in the AL Central and the AL in general. And so, still, 26% is astonishing. And I think it's also a good time to zoom farther out and think about where the White Sox were 2 years ago. And a good way to do that is to think about the last time the Los Angeles Dodgers came to town, which is what is about to happen this weekend. The White Sox this week just beat the Braves twice at home. The third game of that series got rained out and postponed, so that's going to be a pain in the ass to reschedule at some point later this season. But now they have the Dodgers coming in. And the Dodgers now with the balanced schedule, you do have NL West teams coming in every couple years. And you just think about where this team was the last time the Dodgers were here, okay? This was late June 2024. you want to guess the records? I mean, I guess you won't be able to do it. There's two amazing things about the series. So unsurprisingly, the Dodgers went there and they swept them, of course.
What?
Surprise, surprise. The scores were 3-0, 4-3, and 4-0. That brought the Dodgers to 51-31. That brought the White Sox to 21-61. This was 2 years ago. Honestly, what is most amazing about the series is who was involved. The starting pitchers in the first game were Garrett Crochet and James Paxton. Okay.
Two big lefties.
That's true. The starting pitchers in the second game were Chris Flexen and Bobby Miller. And the starting pitchers in the third game were Eric Fetty in his first White Sox stint before he was traded to the Cardinals, and Gavin Stone, complete game shutout. Remember him? So a lot of new characters in this series this weekend. We've got Roki against Anthony Kay in a legendary NPB showdown on Friday. Yamamoto, Sean Burke, Saturday, Emmett Sheehan, Eric Fetty. Eric Fetty's still part of this series 2 years later.
Can't kill him.
And it's the Camelback Ranch Bowl. I have covered the Dodgers in spring training the last few seasons, and every time I look over at the White Sox side and be like, wow, that is a different universe over there. And yet I do think back to this spring when I went over there for the Murakami first presser of the spring, and I was just like, you know what? Like, these guys are in a good mood. And Murakami was a big part of that. But even at that point, we still thought this team's going to suck. They'll have the kids come up and play, and it'll be enjoyable to watch, but they're going to be bad. And yet they think they were feeling good. And look at them now. So I am so excited for this series this weekend. I'm really curious to see if they can really make some noise. I can't wait. Now, that said, we have one more Dodgers note before we go around the league. Shohei Ohtani, you may have heard of. he did not finish the baseball game last night, and not just because he was a pitcher and got removed. No, he was removed. He was pinch hit for, which I'm not sure how many times that has happened for Mr. Ohtani in the last however many years. He left the series finale in Pittsburgh with left knee discomfort. Dave Roberts after the game saying, "We're not worried. This was proactive." He did not say, "I have to get out of the game." He expects him to be in the lineup on Friday. So we're going to take him at his word as we record this on Friday morning. But anything with Ohtani is important. And also in this case, there was that little added level of, hey, wait a minute. Isn't that that same knee that he got surgery on at the end of 2019? Yes, it is. But that was a long time ago, and we certainly haven't heard anything about this since. He said this was also kind of more hamstring than knee. Whatever it is, anything with Ohtani is important. And hey, even if he misses one game, that's good news for the Chicago White Sox as they try and continue this little hot stretch. So they're not going to have to face Ohtani on the mound, so that's good. But yeah, I mean, let's just keep an eye on this one. That's not
Jordan. You know how much I love the Pope. You know how much I love the Pope. I'm currently down a rabbit hole of different types of like papal announcements. Right? There's like papal decrees and papal communications. The one I like here is apostolic exhortations, which are papal reflections on a particular topic, which are addressed to all of the clergy and faithful. I would like an apostolic exhortation on the small market, common man White Sox in their battle against the greedy capitalist Dodgers from Pope Bob as we head into this showdown on the South Side.
Before or after? Like after they win the series before. Or just like...
Before or okay, after.
Okay, so I kind of set the tone.
It feels more papal to do it ahead of time.
Hmm. Certainly the safer option before they get... Well, maybe it's had to be papal. But maybe if they get swept and, you know, lose by a million runs and all the rich, famous Dodgers are, you know, beaten up on these rookies making the minimum, maybe that's the time you make a statement.
I asked this earlier this year about the Pope, who loves his Sox. How... And I want to check in again as these White Sox continue to win games. How many White Sox does the Pope know? How many current Chicago White Sox does Pope Bob know by name?
Honestly, I think the real question is, has that number increased since the start of the season? Has that number increased? That is what I am wondering. All right. Enough Pope chat. Enough Ohtani chat. We got another big update in the AL Central. Let's go around the league. That's right, folks. It's happening. Daniel Espino is coming to the major leagues. Sorry. We'll get to that in a second. Mm. Tarek Skubal is going to pitch in a Major League Baseball game on Saturday in Cleveland, Ohio. I'll just get this out of the way. I will not be there because of prior obligations. However, nobody cares that I won't be there. The point is that Tarek Skubal's pitching in the big leagues after having elbow surgery 30-something days ago. This is an astonishing sequence. I'm sure if you went back and listened to all of those things we said, not just us, everyone was saying in the 24 to 48 hours after it was initially announced that Tarek Skubal would need surgeries to remove loose bodies, what turned out to be loose body. It sounded like there wasn't actually that much going on in the elbow.
Loose bodies.
We were like, wow, that's terrible news for this Tigers team. And who knows if we'll see Skubal again before the trade deadline, let alone the end of the season. The Tigers proceeded to play horrific baseball over the next 3 weeks that have put them in quite the hole. However, they have looked a little bit better over the last week. And now they get Tarek Skubal back right on time to face a Guardians team that is also struggling and has fallen behind those Chicago White Sox. Tigers-Guardians games have always been important and compelling over the last three seasons. We should also note that the Tigers got mopped by the Guardians during this stretch over the last month. So they are looking to exact some revenge and climb back up the AL Central standings. But most importantly, Skubal is back. And what is so interesting about this is that I think I mentioned this when we talked about him on the pod earlier this week or last week. So many people are invested in how he looks, right? That includes Austin Hedges, right? That includes like the teams that are going to have to prepare for him. That includes the Tigers themselves, Tigers fans, rival GM, Scott Harris. Tarek Skubal cannot by himself sway the Tigers playoff odds, but him coming back and looking good is just a, it's, you know, one of the biggest stories of the season. So we'll see how it goes.
This is the most remarkable comeback we have seen in recent baseball memory. A month and change for any sort of elbow procedure is unthinkable. I do not feel bad for doubting him because this involved medical technology that we did not know existed.
Yeah, right. And I was going to say that I do think is a very important point and why I would push back on saying this is the most amazing comeback ever, because he was attempting. He's doing something that has never been done, but it's also he had a new.
Right.
We're not measuring him on the same timeline, and because this timeline didn't exist. So if this becomes normal and guys are just coming back in 4 to 5 weeks from this arthroscopic elbow surgery, this will be the first one, but it won't seem as remarkable in retrospect. But because we've never seen it before, our minds are still a little blown.
So earlier this week, I went on a little rant piece about how the nano needle Skubal scope should be named after the person that came up with it, unlike Tommy John surgery, which is named after the person that received it. We got an email from someone named Travis, who is a biomedical engineer that works in the sports medicine industry, which is why I love our show. It's like, yeah, of course someone who works in sports medicine industry is a biomedical engineer is just going to send us an email. Travis basically explains that the way that these medical developments work is that they're usually done in conjunction with a big time famous surgeon. And in this case, that is Dr. Neil Elitrotch. And that Neil Elitrotch, if anybody is going to receive credit for this, it would be him. And I agree with that. However, why don't we hold off on that until Dr. Neil Elitrotch is cleared of any wrongdoing in this Conor McGregor PED situation, and we can circle back maybe in a month or two.
Yeah, this is tough timing to probably be asking Tarek Skubal questions about Neil Elitrotch on Saturday. But it's still amazing. And we will this is just another chapter of the incredible Skubal story. However, as I mentioned earlier, I do want to make sure we say and make note that Daniel Espino is coming to the big leagues. And
who he?
This is also a medical miracle, I would say, if we're being honest. In fact, I would say this is more amazing than Tarek Skubal coming back in a month from with a surgery, a innovative, revolutionary surgery. Because Daniel Espino, who was the Cleveland first-round pick in 2019 out of high school, was so injured early in his career that he barely pitched. I mean, he missed almost all of 22, all of 2023, all of 2024. He's dealt with elbow, he's dealt with shoulder, he's dealt with everything. And all along, when he's been on the mound, certainly before that string, I mean, what he looked like in 2021 was just absurd. He has some of the best stuff in the minor leagues. Now, that has not been totally the case since he came back last year, but he's still throwing really hard. He's still striking out a bunch of guys. And for a Guardians bullpen that kind of needs a bit of a boost, I'm so excited to see this guy get a chance. He has been through all kinds of rehabs to get to this point. He is 25 years old, born in Panama, went to high school in Georgia. Awesome kid. We were there on his draft day in 2019. And now he's not really a kid anymore. He's a big leaguer, though, which is really, really, really awesome. So congrats to Daniel Espino. Excited to see him in the Guardians bullpen. Pitchers, man, their arms are just... This is one of the most incredible... There were many times where I was like, well, okay, that's sad. We'll never see Daniel Espino. Kept working. Now he's in the big leagues. Really, really cool story.
Life is long.
Yeah, indeed. A couple other quick injury updates before we take a break. Ronald Acuna Jr. is back on the IL. And this sucks. Yikes. This is a grade one hamstring strain. I am just so bummed by this because we really had like a 7 to 10 day stretch where it was like, okay, here we go. He's there's Ronald. Here come the Braves. And instead, he pulls up again, running the bases, and is back on the IL. So hopefully this isn't super long term. It just sucks to see him.
No reason to be worried about his lower half. No reason to be worried about his knees.
That's the other thing, is he's adding to his lengthy resume, terrible word choice, of lower body injuries. It sucks for a guy whose speed has, I guess, fluctuated as part of his game over the years. But yeah, it's just a bummer. And the Braves are fine. They have plenty of other good baseball players. Now, I will say one other injury we should mention is that O'Neill Cruz goes to the injured list. This is really not a player. I know you were just in Pittsburgh. O'Neill Cruz has a broken hand. He's going to be out for at least a month. I don't think we've talked a lot about Brandon Lau and Spencer Horwitz, and he was there last year, and Connor Griffin. I mean, O'Neill Cruz was doing it. Like, he had a 126 OPS plus. You kind of got to, and he's had some really terrible moments in center field that I've certainly been highlighted more often, but you got to feel good about what he's been able to give you offensively this season. He's been a big part of their resurgence as well in the lineup.
He seemed to be in good spirits 2 days ago when I saw him scootering through the tunnel at PNC Park with a cast on his hand, with like one of the, like, not a cast, like one of those wrist brace things, like him and Dennis Santana just whipping it.
Yeah. I also just love O'Neill Cruz because he's striking out. He had a 35% strikeout rate, but he's one of those few people on earth that when you're hitting the ball that hard, when you are doing it, when you are hitting the ball, even if you're whiffing that much, you can be an impact player. And that's what he has been. So let's see how the Pirates weather this storm of injuries, because that is not super ideal. All right, Jake Mintz, are you that urgent? Do you desperately want to talk about Derek Hill and the Phillies? If not, we're going to go to break.
Let's go to break.
All right, let's go to break. Sorry, Derek Hill. We'll be right back with the good, the bad, the ugly. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we do the good, the bad, the ugly, we need to talk about Omaha.
This is the first time, Jordan, that I will not be in Omaha since the Pandy.
Ooh.
And I am feeling significant FOMO. It's the least I've watched college baseball in a long time. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed by that sad reality. Life finds a way to take good things from you. And yet it doesn't matter, because we have arrived at the end of the season, and anybody, even a loser like me, can hop back in at this point in time.
Yes. So I wrote my preview for Omaha. You can read it on Yahoo Sports. Highlighted one player on each team. Also talked about some of the other parts of these team stories leading up to the Men's College World Series. But really what I wanted to highlight in this brief conversation, but also ask you, like, even as someone who hasn't followed it as closely this season, what are you interested in? The part that I just want to make sure I communicate, because I think that, of course, we could talk about players all day long, and that's what my piece is mostly about. But what I wrote my intro about is just how unusual this field of teams is. There are just some incredible fun facts about how unlikely this group of eight is. And that's the part that I'm so excited about, is just to see who ends up emerging out of this group, because what a weird selection of teams. The tone was set early in this tournament when the top two seeds crash out, as we'll say in the World Cup, crashed out in regionals, Georgia Tech, UCLA. The fact that we have five teams from the SEC, the most ever from a single conference, out of these eight, and yet none of them include teams that have won national titles over the last 10 years. LSU, Vanderbilt, Mississippi State, Florida, right? Arkansas, who hasn't won at all, but they're not in the mix here. Instead, we have Georgia, Alabama, football powerhouses are now there, Texas, Oklahoma, and Ole Miss, who did win it all in 2022. You have a natural Cinderella in Troy, who is the only mid-major in the field. North Carolina, who's there for, I think, the 11th time, but has never won at all. And then West Virginia, you've seen them singing Country Roads in Morgantown, and they're just a really fun team. They're in Omaha for the first time. So I'll just throw it back to you. What are you What are you excited about, even as someone who hasn't been watching? Like, when you look at this field, is there a player, is there a team that you're thinking, a coach that you're thinking about the most going into this this World Series?
So the first thing is, I'm just disappointed that Troy's there and Gabriella won't be.
She also crashed out in the regional round. I think that was in Hattiesburg.
Cole Tucker. Yeah. Cole Tucker, step up. Get Gabriella out there with Troy. That is a High School Musical and Pirates infielder joke in one. As far as this actual tournament, to answer your actual question, Daniel Jackson of Georgia is the player that I am most interested in. He is the favorite to win the Golden Spikes Player of the Year award, as I understand it, and is not someone that was on my radar at all before the season. Can you kind of give people an overview on him?
Yeah. Now Georgia's whole team is transfers, except for the third baseman, Trey Phelps. He's like their only actual recruit. Daniel Jackson is one of those transfers, but this is his second year in Athens. He started his career at Wofford. And last year he was interesting. He's a very athletic catcher, and the physicality, those tools pop, striking out a lot last season, but he had some impressive numbers considering he was transferring from Wofford to the SEC. But then this year, and it sounded like in fall ball, it was like, hold on, Daniel Jackson's taking a leap. He's just gone supersonic. He's stolen like 26 bases as a catcher. He's hit 31 homers. He's cut down on the strikeouts. And he's just a game-changing talent. Interestingly, his pro prospects, statistically, you would look at it and be like, what more do you want to see? This guy's clearly a top 10 pick. The swing and miss and the defense behind the plate, a little bit more inconsistent. So he's probably more likely to be a 20 to 40 pick than a top 20 pick in the draft next month. That said, that doesn't matter right now. Georgia's trying to win their first national title since a really long time ago. 1990 was the last and only time that Georgia won it all, and Daniel Jackson's going to be a huge part of that. So yeah, he's fun to watch.
The one other guy I think we need to talk about is Justin LeBron, not just because his name is LeBron. This is great. If LeBron retires as Justin LeBron enters superstardom, people thought Bronny James was going to be, the torchbearer. No, it's Justin LeBron, Alabama shortstop.
Yes. No capital B, though. We should make sure that when we're editing, we know that it's just the lowercase B in LeBron. But this is also, as far as prospects goes, probably the biggest name left. And yet, this is interesting. Could Justin LeBron go after Daniel Jackson in the draft? It's possible, which would seem totally inconceivable at the start of the season when people thought Justin LeBron could be the number one overall pick. His numbers in the SEC were just not very good. And yet when you watch the guy play baseball, you would say, get this guy on my team. He is a incredible athlete at shortstop, fantastic defender, has stolen 41 bases, has only been caught twice. When you see him connect, the ball's going to go a long way. Just such a fun player to watch on both sides of the ball. And yet, there are definitely holes in his profile. However, as for his pro potential, no one cares about that. Alabama is trying to win their first ever national championship. They are in Omaha for the first time since 1999. And for them to emerge as a real baseball power this season has been really impressive. The one thing that worries me about Alabama is that they've had by far the easiest road to get to this point in terms of their regional and in terms of who they face in Supers, with all due respect to St. John's. So they are in for now. It's like, okay, you're facing Oklahoma, you're facing this other side of the bracket, Georgia and Texas. They got some work to do. So I would be surprised if Alabama goes on a deep run in Omaha, but Justin LeBron is going to have to do so. He can shut me up here in the next couple weeks.
All right. It's Friday. Let's do it. Good, bad, and ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing offbeat, bizarre, fun, notable from the week that was. Jordan, start us off.
It is Pride Month in the month of June. And of course, we talked about the Dodgers had their Pride night, and we had Roki Sasaki wearing the Pride hat and the Dodgers wearing the Pride hats and Roki looking as best as he ever has. So I hope he's wearing the Pride hat tonight. Yeah. Roki Sasaki. I hope that he is wearing the Pride hat on Friday in Chicago. I hope he travels with it and absolutely dominates. However, My good this week is Spencer Strider, who made an appearance at the Atlanta Braves Pride social event, which they hosted, I believe, across the stadium, across the street from Truist Park at the Roxy Theater. This is a very simple, like, not anything too outlandish, but Spencer Strider went to this event, you know, full of people in the Braves fans community and the LGBTQ plus community. And he went in there and he said, "Hey, thank you guys for being here. We want baseball to be inclusive." Yep. And it's such a small thing, but for Spencer Strider, who is, of course, one of the most important players on the Braves and one of the more famous pitchers that we have in the league, these kinds of acts going out of their way to show inclusivity, to communicate yeah. that this is a space for everybody in baseball is so important and goes such a long way. And something that I can just appreciate, knowing how often we have to talk about players doing the opposite, pointing the other direction, Blake Treinen refusing to wear the Pride hat. We've had other cases of players going out of their way to denounce or distance themselves from some of these events, which has been so discouraging in, you know, at this time in human history. And so it feels like a small thing. And unfortunately, I guess it's kind of rare. Yes, we have a lot of players that go along with it, which is nice and good. But to go out of your way and to spend time to go and speak to the community of fans that is often not heard and not listened to and not respected, it's just awesome. So it's pretty straightforward, but good for Spencer.
And he didn't. And the thing about this is, like, Spencer, who is one of the smarter, like, more cerebral dudes in the sport, did not say anything particularly, like, insightful or earth-shattering or elaborate. Like, he was just like, "Hey, thanks for being here. Means a lot. We want baseball to be inclusive." It's something that, like, a executive could have said. And yet, because it came from Spencer Strider, who walked across the street to deliver this message, it goes so far. Good for Spencer. And it's just a reminder that it doesn't take that much. Just, like, be a regular dude. You know what I mean? Just don't be a freaking weirdo or a loser. And, like, you can have a really good impact on people's lives. And good for Spencer for doing that. My good this week is Trey Mancini, who is a big leaguer once again. Earlier, I think you and I were bantering about how whenever there are these feel-good stories for terrible teams, there is something feel-bad about it, because it's like, well, only the Angels would allow for... Like, if Trey Mancini is playing for your baseball team in 2026, something did probably go wrong, whether it's injuries or underperformance. But that takes nothing away from Trey Mancini, one of our favorite people in the sport. Trey, who had cancer... came back, played with the Orioles, kind of had some age-related decline after a trade to Houston, bounced around Chicago, Arizona, was like in the Marlins system for a bit, got up this week with the Angels, got a hit in his first game back. Just hats off to Trey for sticking with it. He had a great, great quote in a Ken Rosenthal story, kind of about how when you're done with the game, it will stop pulling you back. And I think about this all the time, Jordan, as someone that did play competitively in college. Whether you are me or you or Trey Mancini or Mike Trout or whomever, at some point, you are done playing. That is like this universal experience of anybody who played baseball at any meaningful level, right? And what Trey Mancini communicated here, that he wasn't yet done, is kind of what I tell people about my own experience. Like, I sleep at night because I knew I squeezed every last drop out of my own ability. And I give Trey Mancini a lot of kudos for, like, the self-awareness to know that he wasn't quite done with it. And it's just, he's the type of guy that I want to see in the sport and I think will be around the game for a long time. So hats off to Trey. Just a great story.
Yeah, I mean, he played 120-something minor league baseball games, you know, over the last 2 years, AAA games, when he probably could have, you would assume there were times when, and he admitted this, that he could have just been like, "Yeah, I'm done. It is telling me that I'm done." But he stuck with it and got to get back to the big leagues. So always good to see for people like that. Let's go to bad. My bad this week is some AI slop. We don't really talk that much about AI in the show, and I don't plan to make it any sort of regular occurrence. However, this just was so bad and made me so angry. Basically, there's this very strange event. It's very modern college baseball happening called the Portal Games, where in Indiana, that's this facility in Indiana in late June, you can show up and play a couple games and showcase BP stuff if you are in the transfer portal. And there will be hundreds of college coaches there representing and saying, yes, come play for us and whatever. Okay. Portal game. So that's the premise. However, the promotion for the Portal Games in year three on their official account, and apparently using some strange like Instagram accounts with a ton of followers that are probably all bots, has put together a list of the teams that are the schools that will be represented at this event. And this AI generated graphic of schools that will be at this event is so just wrong and sloppy and weird that it made me laugh and also made me angry. And the worst part is not just that they have a graphic showing Middle Tennessee with Marshall's logo or schools that don't even exist just because whatever AI generated, whatever they use has just conjured up completely fake schools that are going to be in attendance at this event. It's that the official Portal Games account, when people have called out that their graphics are AI slop, are responding and being like, ah, yeah, it is. Sorry, we suck at making graphics, but thanks for the exposure. And it's like, God, this is so... it's just so dystopic and stupid. And it just makes me mad. And so it is bad. There's my bad.
These are just not schools. There's just some not schools on here.
There's so many. By not I could schools. Go for 15 minutes of the mistakes on here. We got Louisiana has Louisville's logo. We've got Marshall has Lincoln Trail Junior College. We have a school that doesn't exist called Citadella.
I think that's supposed to be the Citadel.
Yeah, but it's like the Chipola logo just completely massacred. The whole thing is awful. And I just hate that their response to it was like, yeah, it is AI slop. Sorry.
Just oops.
Bad.
Okay. From AI slop to someone that's actually writing a book. Orioles owner David Rubenstein has picked up the pen and is releasing a book about his experiences as owner of the Baltimore Orioles. This is from Jacob Calvin Meyer, the Orioles beat reporter of the Baltimore Sun. Inside the Owner's Box, Conversations on Power and Leadership in Sports will be released in September. It will include Rubenstein's own experience and conversations with other owners. This is good because, like, we'll probably learn some stuff here about his process, and I'm sure he'll accidentally reveal some interesting things about the Orioles. Writing a book about your experience as an owner, having accomplished nothing as an owner, is very funny.
And
2 years
having
in,
barely done it. What is there even? Yes, your first point is spot on. What have you accomplished that you would like to share about? Which to me, the takeaway, and we've known this before he even bought the team, because he's doing, this guy's just a content king. He's just trying to get his,
yeah,
he just wants to share his empire story.
Yeah.
Which is probably not, should be the, probably shouldn't be the focus right now.
It's like if you wrote a book after your kid turned two for like thoughts on fatherhood, you know? It's like,
that's an interesting comparison that I imagine actual parents will push back on. But from where I sit, who as someone who also has not had kids, yeah, I do think that that is a decent analogy. But I also think there
it's
probably
just
some
like,
people out there that says, Jake, shut up. What are you talking about?
Here's my last question about this. Who's this for? What is the 100%. Audience for Inside the Owner's Box? Now, I guess that is maybe true about all of Rubenstein's content world, his content empire. But like, are other owners reading this book looking for tips? How many prospective owners are grinding like, tape? Like, there's like eight of those people in the world. Like, it's so funny.
Right, are the new Padres owners going to pick this up and be like, all right, let's see what I can learn here.
Did you see the other David Rubenstein story that's more ugly than anything?
No.
Orioles owner David Rubenstein marries Karen in secret DC wedding. Secret wedding.
I did see Rubenstein's secret wedding. And yeah, that is ugly. And I should probably educate myself more before I comment further.
Like, was this like a Roki? Did Roki have secret wife? No, Otani had secret wife.
Yeah. Secret wife.
Otani had secret, normal Japanese woman.
So he's owning the Orioles and he has a secret wedding, writing a book. Interesting. What a strange fellow. Okay, let's go to actual Ugla.
The team is currently a few games under 500.
Maybe, honestly, here's the comparison. Are we just going to end up with like the Netflix Red Sox equivalent where it's not an interesting look at a team that is relevant?
True.
But anyway. All right, my Ugla is... Carson Fulmer. Carson Fulmer was the first round pick by the Chicago White Sox in 2015. Friend of the show. We played Fungo Golf with him not once, but twice. But my Ugla is the fact that Carson Fulmer has been acquired by the Pittsburgh Pirates four separate times and has never pitched for them. And I'm mentioning it now because Carson Fulmer was just traded from the AAA Pirates to the Seattle Mariners, where he made his organizational debut last night with Tacoma. But this is something that when I was in Pittsburgh, we were yapping about with the Pirates media folks. And that was before he was traded again. But I just can't get over this. This is just the weirdest thing ever. Carson Fulmer was first claimed by the Pirates in 2020. In fact, he was activated during the 2020 season for 4 days and did not get in a game despite the Pirates using like a billion pitchers during that week in late August. He was then DFA'd, claimed by the Orioles. And then 3 weeks later, the Pirates claimed him again. But they didn't activate him. He gets released. He bounces between a bunch of teams. The Pirates sign him in December 2024, minor league deal. He pitches in Indianapolis in 13 games and then gets released. Goes back to the Angels, appears with them in the big leagues. Pirates, they're like, no, we're not done. This is the time that Carson Fulmer is going to pitch for us. They sign him in February of 2026. He goes back to Indy. Surely he could surface in this year where the Pirates bullpen could use some help. Nope. Nope, nope, nope. Pitches 16 games with Indy and is traded to Seattle. I don't know what the hell's going on here, but it is very ugly. I hope that Carson Fulmer, I am excited if I get to see Carson Fulmer at some point to ask him about his experience with the Pittsburgh Pirates, because this is just as ugly.
Pirates legend. Retire his number.
I want that shirt.
My Ugla got a little bit more run on the internet, but we still definitely got to talk about it. The Giants Nats game on Wednesday was maybe the game of the year, in which the Gigantes came roaring back from a massive deficit to score 5 runs in the 8th and 5 in the 9th before winning on a walk-off grand slam from Bryce Eldridge. Awesome moment. Like, really freaking cool. Eldridge, who grew up in the D.C. area, grew up a Nats fan, has a picture with Dan Colco as a 12-year-old that Dan Colco, who's now the Nats broadcaster, tweeted. It's, like, incredible. Just, like, small world stuff, right? It makes me feel ancient. But I'm talking about a different broadcast. The Tarps Off phenomenon, I'm sure many of you listening are familiar. I'm just going to read this back and forth between the two legendary members of the Giants broadcast, Wayne Kuiper, Mike Kruko. Kuiper, it may be more Tarps Off. Excuse me. Kuiper, it may be more than Tarps Off if Eldridge knocks one out of here. Kruko, I'm going to hold you to it. Time to drop trow, hog out. A lot of ridiculous things have been said on broadcasts over the years. Things both nonsensical and insulting. Things of all shapes and sizes. I think this could be the most out-of-pocket thing that anybody has ever said on a baseball broadcast. Drop trow, hog out is like, Like, I'm not saying that he should be fired or suspended, but and he gets away with it because of, like, you know, like, he's the way he says it and what. It is nuts. You could just say this on television, I guess.
Seconds before a walk-off grand slam, this could have been lost to history. Instead, this is just part of the lore. Of this
drop Trout and hog out. hog
I
out.
Guess it was on radio, not TV. I'm pretty sure, but maybe I'm wrong. Either way, I mean, this is absurd. This is, I can't believe this was said. Is this something like, has Kruko said stuff that's like totally
horny?
Make you say, well, excuse me?
Yeah, sometimes.
To me.
The other thing that's funny about this is like, hog out as an activity, as like an action is funny to me. Like,
actually,
hogging
let
out.
Let me push back. Like, let me push back. Drop Trow. That we're overlooking Drop Trow as a
you've
as
never
a,
heard like, Drop Trow.
No, I have heard that, and yet I certainly haven't heard it on a baseball broadcast. And so it's like that is, I feel like, being underrated.
Yeah,
and then it just got one upped immediately.
This phrase "drop Trow hog out" is bringing together two different generations of speech. I think too, like. Drop yes, Trow feels very 1970s, and hog out feels very Gen Z.
Well said.
Something beautiful about it when you think about it.
Yeah. It's appropriate for, you know, Bryce Aldridge.
You know what I won't be doing this weekend?
Two? Yeah. What?
I will not be dropping Trow and hogging out at a
also,
baseball
I just
stadium
gotta say,
because.
I'll be honest. I'm actually worried because if this sparks the Giants' resurgence, like Giants,
are we
going to
see
Giants ballpark security should be on edge? All right, because
bold
again, remember, I should say, tarps off. I understand that the original origins is college football, whatever, but part of the reason why it went so was what it. With the Cardinals, like there was this rising victory, and then the team embraced it. This is a moment. This is every bit the moment of the Giants. See a Walker come back from 9-1, Giants grand slam.
Yeah.
Bryce Eldridge, the guy who wants to be the face of the team. So I'm worried
dangerous.
That this is actually, this could really be the beginning of this Trout dropping story.
I think you could be. Thankfully, the Giants remain a. You know, stop-start baseball team.
Probably not going to happen. All right, we're done. Thank you all for listening to this Friday edition of Baseball Barbie Guys. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Colin Brennan for producing.
A lot of great games this weekend, and if you're going to watch any of them in person, make sure you keep your frickin' pants on. I will be at Mariners Nats here in D.C. We've got Braves at the Mets, Dodgers at the White Sox, which we talked about. I love the Braves-Mets first showdown between these two teams all season, and the Mets are 15 games back. What a thing. Rockies will be in Vegas to play the A's. Cubs-Giants, is the Sunday Night Baseball showdown. I'm interested in Padres-Orioles and Yankees-Blue Jays are the two that I'll be tuning into a little bit with more focus. Jordan.
I agree.
Have a great weekend. my favorite soccer team plays this weekend. The Scottish.
Yes. Scotland, Haiti on Saturday night. I'll be definitely checking out on Brazil, Morocco. Just a correction. Unfortunately, it is actually Rangers Red Sox on Sunday Night Baseball. So I'm sure that broadcast, hopefully those preparing for that broadcast, Jason Benetti, enjoyed our conversation to start this episode of Baseball Barbacast to get ready for the Rangers and the Red Sox. All right, we're done. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.